From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. A whistleblower complaint led to confirmation. President Trump asked Ukraine's president to investigate the work of Joe Biden's son for a Ukrainian gas company. Democrats say they want to know whether there was an implied quid pro quo of U.S. financial aid attached. Trump's responded by calling for an investigation into the Bidens. That and more politics after the news. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you had a wonderful weekend. Great to have you with us as we start the week every Monday. That means politics conversation. We're going to be getting to that momentarily. New polls, by the way, showing a statistical dead heat in Iowa, where the eyes of all the candidates are right now, as well as considerable amounts of time spent. But we begin with the story you just heard on NPR News, President Trump's conversation last July with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Yesterday, the president confirming that he'd asked Zelensky about potential corruption by former VP Joe Biden. The White House has blocked Congress's access to a whistleblower complaint about the call. That's led additional Democrats to say they're now open to pursuing impeachment. Last Friday, during a news presser, President Trump was asked whether he knew the identity of the whistleblower.
I don't know the identity of the whistleblower. I just hear it's a partisan person, meaning it comes out from another party. But I don't have any idea. But I can say that it was a totally appropriate conversation. It was actually a beautiful conversation.
And we've had a bit more detail from the president on that since those comments Friday. With us to take a step back and sort of give us the context for the concerns around this conversation, as well as the process of handling the whistleblower's complaint, is NPR senior editor and correspondent, the man on politics, Ron Elving. Ron, thank you so much for joining us. Let's start first of all with what we know about the whistleblower complaint, the process here. What has kept that from getting to Congress?
The White House and the Attorney General William Barr have kept that from getting to Congress. And it's good to be with you, Larry. This is an important moment, I think, an inflection point for the discussion of Donald Trump's presidency and its future. The reason people are so upset about this is there is a clear law governing this process. It's called the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act. It's been on the books for many years. And the idea is that if anyone in the intelligence community sees wrongdoing or sees something suspicious or sees something that is against the law, that person is supposed to report it up the line to the Inspector General for the whole intelligence community. That's the CIA and all the other agencies involved in the intelligence community. Apparently someone has done that about this call back in July. That doesn't seem to be in any dispute. The report went up to the Inspector General, Michael Atkinson. He looked it over. He said he took it to be serious and urgent and passed it on, as the law specifies, to the acting director of national intelligence. This is the person who is in charge of all those bureaus. His name is Joseph McGuire, and he tried to take it on, as the law requires, to Congress, but first consulted with the Attorney General William Barr and with the president or someone in the White House, and was advised that he should not share any more about this whistleblower complaint or about the phone call that it was based on with the Congress. And that, in and of itself, could become the basis for an impeachment proceeding tied into the also stonewalled requests for other documents and witnesses back over a period of months.
Do we know, Ron, what McGuire was told by the Attorney General or by the White House official or the president as to the reason why the report should not be shared? I mean, was there some attempt at providing a legal explanation to our knowledge?
To our knowledge, it was told to the Director of National Intelligence that this simply shouldn't be shared, that this wasn't something that he had to share, that it didn't fall under the purview of the law or something to that effect. In any event, he was given conflicting instructions, one from his boss, the president, and the attorney general, who has been so important to all of this strategy of absolutely refusing any cooperation at all with another constitutionally empowered branch of the government. And he then had the conflict of that with the clear requirements and dictates of the law. So that's where he is at this particular time, and he is clearly hamstrung and is going to be a backup in testifying later on this week. That's certainly something everybody's looking forward to. On Thursday, the president has said he might at some point release a transcript of the telephone call from back in July. But look, this is the context for this that really has to be emphasized. At the time of that telephone conversation, and for a number of weeks thereafter, the White House was holding up $250 million in military assistance to Ukraine so that they can resist aggression from Russia on their eastern frontier. This was money that Kiev was absolutely counting on. It's existential for them. And Congress had approved it. House and Senate, Republicans, Democrats, everyone, and the military leaders had approved it. Nothing was holding it up but the White House, which said it wanted to see whether or not they thought Ukraine was really aligned with our interests before they released the money. And in that context, we have the phone call between Trump and Zelensky, and Trump urging Zelensky to investigate the Biden family.
So without having the transcript, we don't know whether there was an explicit or implied quid pro quo. But the fact this $250 million was hanging out there contingent on something has led to the speculation that there could have been. And then let's step back and take a look at Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, who apparently was working for a gas company owned by a Ukrainian oligarch. I've just read in conservative media, apparently, the allegation that Hunter Biden was working for a number of different international interests. They frame it, of course, as Hunter trying to ride his father's coattails, that he would be working for entities that might want to curry favor with the then vice president. What can you tell us about the kind of work Hunter Biden was doing?
He had, as you say, interest in a number of countries. He and his business partners had some interest in China. They had some interest in Ukraine. Many people did. And a lot of Washington power figures back over a number of years have had various dealings with different governments in Ukraine. That was part of the indictment of Paul Manafort, as you remember, just a couple of years ago. And he's now in jail. That was not the only source of his trouble by any means. But he was another one of the people who had business dealings there. And there have been a number of Republicans and Democrats who have. Some of them have been charged with, in some sense or another, violating one law or another, such as, for example, the requirement that you file as a lobbyist for a foreign interest. None of those kinds of charges has come Hunter Biden's way. This is a new accusation that seems to be coming primarily from activists on the right, people like Tom Fitton, from a group called Judicial Watch. Has been around for a number of years, been something of a gadfly for both kinds of administrations, and people of that nature. The president has been sending Rudy Giuliani over to Ukraine for a number of months, and by the way, not only Ukraine, but other countries, to raise issues of corruption in those countries and to suggest solutions for that corruption, which seem to have to do with prosecuting in some way or another people who would be seen as not friends of the president. So what all of this is about is probably going to eventuate at some point. We should see a lot more information about all of this. And at this juncture, we in the media are simply asking people to say, bring forth your evidence, bring forth your accusations. What are you accusing people of doing?
Let me throw a hypothetical your way, see if you have an opinion on this. So let's say, hypothetically, the transcript of the conversation is released. There's nothing explicitly there. But, of course, we have hanging out there the $250 million in aid that you talked about. Do you think it likely, if there isn't something explicit and it is released to the House Intelligence Committee, that there would still be efforts to try and go after the president on this?
Certainly there would, because the, as you say, it's hanging out there. Everyone knows what the telephone conversation is about. It was not simply a congratulatory call, although Zelensky had just been elected. This was the issue in Kiev at the time. This was the issue in Ukraine. So no telephone call with President Trump, who was the person, after all, suspending the aid. No telephone call with President Trump could have been seen outside of that context. So, yes, people are still going to think that the president urging some kind of action against a political opponent, trying to get some kind of information that might be damaging to one of his prospective challengers in 2020, Joe Biden, anything of that nature would be essentially using American foreign policy for his reelection purpose, and that is clearly against the law, and that is exactly the kind of thing that the Mueller investigation was looking into and found many, many cases of potential obstruction of justice. We only know that Mueller was not able to indict the president because he is a sitting president. That's a policy of the Justice Department that bound the Mueller investigation from the beginning. This is why Nancy Pelosi told NPR on Friday afternoon, we need some other tools. We need some other weapons in the arsenal besides the nuclear weapon of impeachment. Don't make us blow up Congress for 6 months or a year just to issue some sort of disapproval or indictment legally of wrongdoing on the part of the administration up to the president and including the president.
Ron, great to talk with you as always. Thank you so much for being with us for this 20 minutes this morning.
Thank you, Larry.
From NPR, senior editor and correspondent, covers Washington politics, Ron Elving. Also joining us, our political analyst, regular part of our program, Sean Walsh, Republican analyst, Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist. Sean, let me start with you, and let me ask you the same hypothetical here. Let's say the transcript's released. There's nothing explicit there. What do you think would be the appropriate response of the House?
Well, I mean, I did listen to your Washington man speak about Nancy Pelosi and opening up impeachment proceedings. I mean, we're getting pretty close to the next election, and I think the American public is the ultimate arbiter of these things, and they will make a determination whether Mr. Trump is fit to stay in office or not. So I think the Democrats are going to hold investigations. Actually, on September 9th, the Democrats announced that the House Intelligence Committee, the Foreign Affairs Committee, and the Government Oversight Committee were all opening investigations on Mr. Giuliani's activities that date back to earlier in the year on this very subject matter. So they've already been there even before this transcript and whistleblower information came forward.
I guess I'm asking you even beyond the political context here, just ethically, do you think it was wrong for the president to bring up Hunter Biden in this conversation with Ukraine at the time that he did it?
I do. I don't know why he had to do it. I mean, President, there are, look, governments the world over, even when they're going into election cycles, try and make sure that their policies do something that is going to help foster and further their reelection. If it's putting no roads and bridges out and members of Congress who got that pass go out and hold a press conference, all the way up to having certain governments take on certain types of activities. So it's just the clumsiness and the ham-handed stuff that I just can't understand why it's being done. Giuliani probably was, you know, dancing on the edge of the precipice when he was going over to Ukraine and trying to stir this issue up. But, you know, there's a lot of issues and there's some questions why Congress actually didn't open up an investigation with Mr. Biden, since he was the Obama point person on Ukraine at the time. And it appears that they, Obama administration and Mr. Biden, fired the prosecutor, recommended firing the prosecutor who claimed he was going to look at Burisma's chairman. So there's a lot of questions here. I just think let them hold their hearings, and if it damages Trump, it damages Trump. The one thing I do worry about, though, is a lot of Republicans, particularly in the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, who have to defend 25 seats, are getting Trump fatigue. They got through the Russia thing. It was bruising for them. They did not want another one of these damn things coming forward. And so I think I worry that you may see more Republicans decide I'm throwing in the towel. I just don't want to campaign in this election cycle, and it will have implications for members of the Republican House and the Republican Senate.
Sean Walsh, Republican political strategist. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist. Matt, your thoughts on what we're learning about the conversation?
my thoughts are I've been working in politics for 20 or 25 years, and I need to get over to Ukraine because apparently people are making a lot of money over there, Gates and Manafort. And now I saw Hunter was making something like 50 grand a month at this place. So apparently I need to get on a plane right after this radio. Look, I do think this is of a different magnitude potentially. Now, we don't know all the facts. So this is typically where everyone's sort of running around with their hair on fire. Welcome to modern media. But I will say if some of this is true, this is borderline banana republic stuff. This is a guy he knew he was going to run against Joe Biden. At least as of right now, there's no evidence there's any wrongdoing. And the prosecutor in charge of Ukraine was completely corrupt. All the European Union wanted to get rid of him. This was a longstanding policy of a lot of people to get rid of him because Ukraine not only was it having its issues with Russia on its border, but also just it's a corrupt place. And the United States does a lot of this type of work, which is trying to root out some of that throughout whatever foreign policy work they're doing. Now, look, maybe we find out something that Biden was doing something improper, but we've never seen that in 45 years of his career to just throw this against the wall and now to make this sort of the equivalent and say, oh, well, there's corruption, we need to look into it is somewhat ridiculous, at least so far. And this is the kind of thing you go after your political opponents by going to some third, with all due respect to Ukraine, kind of a two-bit dictatorship or borderline and sort of looking them to look into your at that time, at least your most high-profile political opponent. So I think this is different than, say, things like Charlottesville or some of his porn star stuff with Stormy Daniels. I mean, a lot of stuff was sort of cultural warfare stuff that everyone's like, he's breaking norms. You and I had talked about this. I never thought there was a lot to the Russia thing. But this is in performance of his specific duties as the leader of a country talking to another leader of a country, potentially, and we don't know, but potentially sort of working either a quid pro quo or some pressure to go after his main political opponent and the political opponent's family. I do think that's of a different order. And if there's a lot more here, I do think holding impeachment off is going to be harder now than it was before. I think the other stuff, I've never thought impeachment was going to happen. But if there's more to this story, this is a different type of scandal than what has come previously for Trump.
And do you think that Sean's right from the Republican perspective to be concerned about further attrition in Congress?
Oh, well, you already see it. You have a whole bunch of resignations that have been coming. There's a lot of concern. There's going to be so this has already happened. There's already concern now, no matter what, because Trump is so personally loathed by a lot of people, even though his numbers have actually held. I'm always amazed at how his favorables and his job approval has held somewhat steady, all things considered. But as you see, you can always get a sense of where the winds are blowing when people start resigning and getting the heck out of Dodge. And a lot of Republicans are getting the heck out of Dodge, this type of thing, because this really could be a real scandal. I mean, this could end up being a real problem. So you've got all the cultural issues and the kind of animosity that Trump engenders just by his personal behavior. But if he has been using the office to try to either enrich himself or, Democrats have been saying that for a while. It's always been a little tenuous. This has the potential to be a lot bigger and sort of validate a lot of those criticisms in a way that I think his hotels and Stormy Daniels and Russiagate and all that didn't really do.
We're talking with Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, Sean Walsh, Republican strategist. Coming up, we're going to talk about the 2020 race. Some very good news in the Iowa poll that just came out for Elizabeth Warren as she's in a statistical dead heat now with Joe Biden. We'll continue in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up in our second hour of Air Talk, we'll take a look at the future of vaping sales with Walmart saying it's going to discontinue all vape products. But then the question is, does that actually put those that vape at a greater risk? Because if you're not going to be buying from major stores that actually vet the solutions that they're selling, does that mean a greater risk of people who vape getting contaminated products? We'll talk about that coming up next hour, later on Air Talk. But we turn our attention right now to the 2020 presidential election with Sean and Matt and Elizabeth Warren, who has been on the steady upswing really since the start of the debates, now shows in a CNN Des Moines Register poll of likely Iowa caucus goers that she and Biden are in a statistical dead heat, and well off the pace is Bernie Sanders, 10 percentage points behind. And then from there, everyone else is in single digits. So, Sean, your thoughts on the growing power of Elizabeth Warren's candidacy?
Well, last time I was on the program, I stated that I thought Elizabeth Warren really was the strongest candidate from a projection perspective. She's hitting on all the kind of liberal, progressive, Bernie Sanders-esque parts of the party, but she explains them in thoughtful, concise, and easy to digest and understand ways and doesn't look like she's kind of running off as a wild man. So it's not a surprise to me that when you compare who the progressive alternative is to Joe Biden, the quote-unquote moderate, that Elizabeth Warren seems to be the person that that wing of the party would gravitate to.
Matt, what do you make of this poll? Now, you know, it's very early February we have to get to, but still, I mean, she's got to be very happy.
We've talked about this for the last 6-8 months. She's running the best campaign. There's no question about it. And that poll, too, so just for your viewers, some of your junkies might know, that's the Des Moines Register poll run by a woman named Ann Seltzer. That's the gold standard poll. The caucuses are always difficult to poll, even more difficult. And we've already seen polling anyway, just generally in states. It's become more of a challenge with cell phones, more online. What kind of accurate reading do you get? But I mention that to say she has been polling the caucus for years and years, and she's the one who typically gets pretty close. You'll see all these ridiculous polls that come out there that won't even be in the ballpark of true. All of that said, look, Warren's running a great campaign. Iowa's a very good state for her. It's a very liberal state caucus in terms of the caucus. Caucus goers are, this isn't a primary. It doesn't get all, you know, you have to really,
you got to be dedicated.
You got to be dedicated to go. It's moved more dovish even over the last 20, 30, or 40 years. She's running a very good campaign, a very substantive campaign. And Iowa is the kind of place where she can do really well. I would make two political points really quickly, if that's one is that she's risen very quickly. She's now going to get real scrutiny. She's gotten away with a lot of I say this potentially as an admiration. She's been very political in this stuff, and that, you know, she's not had to answer. She's going to have huge tax increases. She's talking about basically giving away the store. You saw it at the last debate around health care. She wouldn't answer if it's going to be a middle class tax
and
cut.
Bernie may decide he needs to go after her.
Well, that's the second thing I was going to say, which is at some point Bernie and Warren are swimming in the same pond, and at the
and,
end of the
and
day,
falling all over each other with compliments.
Yeah, with compliments. That's all going to stop. Somehow they're going to the love affair is about to end, Larry. These things. And they're going to have to open up on her. Now, look, she's run very well. She's done a very good job of avoiding some of the pitfalls. But a lot of her answers are also somewhat disingenuous. And again, I say that all politicians do that. So that's not a criticism. But things like, are you going to raise taxes for health care? And her saying, this is about costs. That she's gotten away with that so far. We're still only in September. She's not going to get away with it any longer. And now we'll see how her campaign holds up to that. She may, and that will be a sort of proving ground for her talent and her staying power moving forward.
Now, in New Hampshire, voters there are feeling very neglected. They're not feeling the love. The candidates really are not paying much attention to New Hampshire, but Iowa's been inundated with Democratic candidates. And with us to talk about that is Reed Epstein, politics reporter for the New York Times, who's been covering what's going on in Iowa. Reed, thanks so much for being with us. How are folks in Iowa taking to all these candidates essentially moving in?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you ask. There certainly is, and frankly has been for a few months, a level of almost exhaustion at how many people are running for president in Iowa. If you talk to voters and activists, they say that, you know, they don't have time for 17 candidates. They are very anxious for the race to get whittled down to a manageable number. And I think that's partly part of the big reason why we see in the Register poll that you guys talked about, a real consolidation around the first tier candidates, that people who are engaged in this, which frankly is a relatively small slice, of voters and even a small slice of people who will come to the caucuses, they want to talk about the candidates they see as viable to win the nomination. And at this point, for most folks there, that you're talking about three, maybe four or five candidates.
All right. And so does that mean you're seeing big attendance differences at the events where people are coming out for Biden, Warren, and Sanders, not so much for the others?
Well, I think, for instance, on Thursday, Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren held events about 2 hours apart, about 4 miles, 3 to 4 miles away from each other in Iowa City, in a suburb of Iowa City called Coralville. And Harris had she had about 200 people. There was a sign on it was in a bar, and there was a sign on the door that said the fire hazard was 167. And her team said that she had a little bit more than that. And 2 hours later, across town, there were 2,000 people for Elizabeth Warren. And it's just, it was really clear the difference in enthusiasm between those two candidates. And part of that is kind of what type of coalition that Warren is building relative to Harris. And like you said, Iowa is a very good state for Harris or candidate like, or for, I'm sorry, for Warren or candidate like Warren. And she has by all accounts run the best Iowa campaign. She's the most organized. And you can see by seeing these candidates kind of in back-to-back situations, you know, her message and her rationale is just so much tighter than anyone else in the race.
One of the things that people have talked about because of these smaller events and frequent ones throughout Iowa, that it would give candidates who have an earnestness about them, a Pete Buttigieg, for example, or an Andrew Yang, sort of an opportunity they might not have elsewhere with the bigger media market states. Are you seeing those candidates lower down getting that kind of more intimate, positive response?
Well, there's certainly a lot of interest in Iowa in Pete Buttigieg. And, you know, you talk to Iowa people and they will tell you that, you know, 100 people will show up basically for anyone who's running for president out of sheer politeness at this point. And so at some level, you know, if people are getting 50 to 100 people, that doesn't say all that much about their campaigns. But there is one big difference this cycle than the last few that I've covered is even since 2016, there's been a big shift to voters getting a much larger percentage of their news from cable TV and social media. And so the days of Jimmy Carter stumping across Iowa, sleeping in people's extra bedrooms, and winning the caucus one voter at a time just isn't possible in 2019 and 2020 because it really is a national campaign. If you go to Dubuque, Iowa, the people there are getting the same news that they're getting if they live in California or Washington.
I guess I was thinking that maybe word of mouth in a state the size of Iowa might make a difference. So, you know, and I'm just pulling his name out because he does seem to do well live events. Pete Buttigieg connects with, 300 people at an event. They come out all energized, tell people, hey, I saw Buttigieg, he's really impressive. And like, that would make a difference. But it sounds like that can't counter mass media.
I think it's just so difficult to compete with the megaphone that you see on cable news. And it's pretty easy to track gains in the polls and fundraising gains for the candidates with the amount of attention they get on MSNBC and CNN. If you talk to these campaign managers, they will tell you that they see the online donations spike just by appearing on Rachel Maddow's show or any of the MSNBC primetime shows. And so it's a real driver of this campaign in a way that we just haven't seen before.
All right. Reid, before I let you go, anything else to add that you think is particularly notable about where we are in Iowa?
You know, the poll this weekend that showed Warren slightly ahead of Vice President Biden, I would not be surprised if that's the last that Joe Biden doesn't lead another Des Moines Register poll of Iowa. His campaign just feels much more obligatory if you see the people who are there than the Warren campaign does at this point. Her events are real events. People come to hear her speak and then they stand in line for hours afterwards to get a picture. Where Biden, it sort of feels like a lot like the Hillary Clinton campaign from 4 years ago, or the Jeb Bush campaign from 4 years ago. It feels like a campaign that people feel like they should be excited about, even though a lot of folks who come to these events, even the supporters, aren't necessarily as jazzed as you might see for folks for Warren or Buttigieg.
Reid, thanks so much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Reid Epstein, who's interviewed the leading Democratic candidates there in Iowa, has followed the numerous events taking place, politics reporter for The New York Times. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation with Matt Rodriguez and Sean Walsh. We have much more on politics. First time for a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking about the state of the 2020 presidential race, where a important poll that was just released shows a statistical dead heat between Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden. That shows Warren's continuing gathering of strength and erosion of Biden's support, and Bernie Sanders in a tough spot. As we've talked about before, Sean Walsh, it seems like Sanders just has not been able to grow that very fervent base that he's had that loves Bernie Sanders, but it's just tough to get beyond that core base.
It is, and you saw Bernie Sanders the last time around, so he's a product that people had a chance to test drive, and I think with Elizabeth Warren around, that's a product that progressives see as a more attractive alternative. You know, it's all about beating Donald Trump. And, you know, Bernie's disheveled, you know, wild hair and his same kind of yelling with the spittle on the side of his lips. I think people question whether he can actually beat Donald Trump. And I think Elizabeth Warren just presents much better. She sounds much clearer. And it's a person that, and she's a woman. And I think that the party can, people see, maybe unite behind her as opposed to Bernie. The other thing was mentioned earlier, Bernie Sanders really did not show a desire to go after Hillary Clinton in the way that normal candidates, you know, really have to mix it up with each other to succeed. And I'm not sure that's in his nature to do that with regards to Elizabeth Warren or even Joe Biden. So the vote's still out as far as I'm concerned as to whether he's got that killer instinct to really, really go after an opponent on issues or potential scandals to try and advance himself. Now, that may be a good thing or a bad thing as a human being, but it's not good if you want to win other states.
Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York City, has dropped out. Cory Booker out of New Jersey, he's looking at, if he can't raise a significant amount of money in the next week, he's probably going to pack it in. That makes sense to you, Matt?
Yeah. There's not a lot of oxygen for some of these. De Blasio had no rationale. There's no reason. He should
have
never.
That was a very strange campaign.
He should never have gotten in the first place. It was a little, it reminded me. It was love Chris Dodd. I remember in 2004, a guy was a senator from Connecticut. There was like zero constituency. No one wanted Chris Dodd to run for president. There was no constituency for it. And he ran, and it materially hurt him. He ended up not running for re-election in 2010 because his internal polling showed that people were really disgusted with the fact that he'd run for president. There was no impetus for it in Connecticut, much less nationally. He got 1%. It was basically as if he hadn't run. And he ended up sort of damaging his political career and ended up leaving from there. De Blasio already had a lot of political problems in New York City. He's a very dislikable guy in a lot of ways, and the media really doesn't like him there either. And then he runs. Yeah, look, I think Booker, Beto, all these folks, I mean, this thing is starting to coalesce around the two lanes, right? There's a kind of liberal lane that Warren is there. Sanders is not going to go away. He still has something to say. And then you've got the Biden side, and no one's really challenged Biden. So everyone's talking about Warren and she's rising. But I think Biden will take that. I think if it's Biden against Warren, he'll take his chances. I'm not saying that he'll definitely win, but I think he'll take a chance that he can get down south, win some African-American voters, get to the middle part of the country, get some of those white working class folks that are going to be a little bit freaked out by the kind of just grandiose plans that Warren has. So I think Biden is just going to keep doing what he's doing until someone challenges him. But I think, you know, Andrew Yang and Booker and Beto, unless something kind of starts to happen here, I don't see what path that they have. And look, Kamala is already starting to hang by a thread here too. She's fallen way down. It's one thing when you're low in the polls. And you know, McCain did this in 2000. He was never sort of registering anywhere. Edwards did a little bit of this in 2004. People forget that he ran in 2004. And they can kind of come back late if they're kind of building something and there feels like there's some momentum. It's a little more difficult to kind of go down and then come back up if you don't have a great kind of rationale for your candidacy. And Kamala is now starting to struggle with that as well. And if she, you know, gets fifth or sixth in Iowa and then fifth or sixth in New Hampshire, I don't know what her path's going to be.
You think she could be out on the early side?
My guess is she'll stay in long enough because I think there's been enough interest in her that she'll at least get to New Hampshire. But I don't see any scenario where she does well in New Hampshire. So, and if she's falling this much in Iowa, it's going to be very difficult to reanimate that for Nevada or South Carolina.
And we should talk about the rules a little bit, just briefly, Matt, in Iowa. Joaquin in South L.A. writing on the page wanted to know about that because you need the 15% threshold.
Yeah, well, that's the challenge that these candidates are going to have, which is why, you know, we have to remember this is still really early. But people, the candidates are going to start really opening up on themselves before. You know, the media always plays up. They'll have one thing in a debate. Someone will take a light jab, or Castro says something snarky. And you know, you'd think that it was like Dresden circa, you know, 1945. But the real criticism is going to start now. And the reason why is, yes, in Iowa, you've got to get 15% threshold in the caucus. So if you're at a caucus location and you have, you know, 8 or 10 potential candidates there and people kind of, you know, go off to their candidates, if you don't get enough threshold there, you need to go re-caucus or caucus with someone else to get to threshold. So that's why these candidates are going to start getting desperate. You can't just get 7, 8, or 9% and then kind of live to fight another day. You're going to get wiped out. And right now you're only talking about a few people near that 15% threshold. Now, look, there's a long way to go. We'll see how Warren stands up to some criticism. Maybe Bernie makes some kind of comeback, maybe about all of that kind of stuff.
But February is going to be here pretty quickly.
But we're heading into October, and then you start getting into the 3-month run here. So they're going to need to start showing something here, or there's going to be real issues, especially with having spent so little time in New Hampshire. You're going to basically, you know, Warren, that's a very regional state. Typically, regional candidates have done well. It's going to be very hard to beat Warren there or Sanders. So now you're looking at, are we going to reanimate in Nevada or South Carolina? So this is going to be a challenge for some of these candidates. And I think you're going to start to see a lot more sharp elbows here in the next 2 to 3 months.
Yeah, Sean, what do you think about how the process in Iowa factors in?
Well, so a couple little bits of history here. So a lot of people who actually have won Iowa historically over the years actually were not the nominees of their party. So a lot of people put a ton of attention on Iowa until 2 weeks later, poof, it's all gone and you're off to, as Matt said, New Hampshire and then South Carolina, California and the rest of the country. So I wouldn't put too much on Iowa. Bush got Big Mo in 80 and then didn't get the nomination from Ronald Reagan. He actually, when he ran in 88, actually came in fourth place behind Pat Robertson and others. So, again, I put limited stuff other than the fact that this will suck all the oxygen out of the, in my view, the down ticket people. Yang could stay in because he's a, you know, rich guy and likes to hear himself talk. But I do think that Booker is basically going to evaporate. If Harris does very poorly here and does not do well in New Hampshire, that has a tendency of withering you in South Carolina. And
where she'd have to show big.
Yeah. Well, in California right now, you know, it, depending on who you talk to, is she the front runner in her own home state? So,
well, she's in,
you know,
and she's in fourth, and she's in fourth in some of the polls here. So her campaign that showed so much promise early is really starting to get really wobbly. And again, it's early. The question is, what do you do to get that back? And that is where it starts to become challenging. And realistically, the way you get that back is attacking the front runners. It's the only way for you to start getting some oxygen here. And that's what some of these down ticket folks who at least have some chance are going to have to try to do if they want to make a real run at this thing.
Well, and then you're always subject to social media criticism. Here's an example. The last debate, and Andrew Yang, this is what he had to say.
I am Asian, so I know a lot of doctors, and they tell me that they spend a lot of time on paperwork, avoiding being sued, and navigating the insurance bureaucracy.
So here he makes a little joke about being Asian, knowing a lot of doctors. Yeah. And then he got backlash on social media as though he's playing into stereotypes about Asian Americans being doctors.
Yeah, I've heard him answer that and said he's not going to change. You know, social media is sort of this corrosive effect where you have to decide what kind of campaign you're going to run, how much you're going to chase that, right? So if you're getting
– or even respond to
it. When I'm getting criticized on Twitter, how long do I let the kind of flames go before I feel like I have to go respond to something? At the same time, yeah, I can see where some people are kind of like, you know, if you're going to run as a first or one of the only sort of top-tier Asian American, not at least top-tier candidate, but he's on the stage at the debates. If you're going to run as an Asian American
– he's qualified.
Yeah. Do you really want to kind of make the kind of constant kind of jokes about this? Do you want to be a little bit more serious? So I don't think the criticism is totally unfounded. I don't wake up every day thinking about it. But at the same time, how serious a campaign are you trying to run? And also, is this the kind of message you want to continue to put forward? So, but social media has just added another leg of the stool. You have to deal with it, which I think most voters are not there and don't care about it. But it is something that you have to tend to and deal with. But you don't want to spend too much time on it, because at the end of the day, you don't just winning what's trending on Twitter.
Well,
won't win
such
the campaign
a small subset of voters. Too,
exactly.
You pay attention to something that has a megaphone but isn't really substantial.
Yeah.
Sean, what do you think about Yang, and how much do you respond to criticism like that?
Well, I believe that there's the exception to every rule. And in this case, stand-up comedians and politicians are allowed to make, you know, self-effacing comments about their ethnicity, their background, et cetera. So African-Americans can do it with themselves, and Jewish folks can, and Asians can, and Irish can, and WASPs can make fun of themselves. So like I say, you get a kind of a mulligan or a pass if you're self-effacing and making fun of yourself.
Well, I was going to say, you know, Jewish candidates, prominent figures make self-deprecating jokes all the time. It's not uncommon at all.
Yeah, we also live in a time where people are hunting this kind of stuff out, right? I mean, and people want to be outraged because that's just the nature of the medium that the media or the mediums that we have out there. And so I agree. But at the end of the day, you have to swim in the pond you're in. You have to fly in the air that you find yourself. And at the end of the day, right now, these types of things are catnip for social media, which then move to the broader conversation like we're having now.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. You know, you do those, you know, St. Patrick's Day roast, and you have had funny jokes about the Irish and all that. But we just live in a different world, for better or for worse. And there's a lot of people who are complaining about it. But it is something you still have to react to and deal with, because the fact is we're talking about it now.
Well, what's funny is even it's a positive. You know, being a doctor is a good thing. We're not talking about
it. Sounds good.
It's not even self-deprecating. We'll continue our conversation with Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, Matt Rodriguez, Democratic analyst, joining us. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Back in 1 minute. The California Senate voted last Friday to ban political parties from using a number of different identifiers, including independent, in their official names. Governor Newsom now has to decide whether he's going to sign the bill, but it's aimed at the American Independent Party, which the thought is that they get many more votes for their candidates on the ballot because there are some voters who aren't all that knowledgeable about politics and assume the American Independent Party is, when they register for it, is independent, like being a declined state voter. Sean, what do you think about this bill and the potential for banning that in a name?
I think it's idiotic. I mean, there has to be something where voters actually get some base knowledge. And I will tell you, one of the most critical elements of running for office is what your ballot designation is. It is proven beyond a doubt that when you have a ballot designation to your name, that actually improves how many people come out, because they aren't that well educated when they do that. But that said, it's on the voters to be educated. It's not up to the state to socially engineer somebody out of existence or a person's party out of existence because they find that too many people are not bright enough to figure out who that person is.
John Morlock, Republican state senator, says the optic smack of political bullying. The American Independent Party has been around longer than many of us have been alive. I think it's a shame. Because I recall the party was created as a vehicle to support George Wallace's presidency. I'm old enough to remember that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit with Sean, and then I'm kind of leery of kind of playing around with the stuff. At the same time, it is a very conservative, borderline, more than conservative group, and it has, I think, more than like Green Party and some of the other groups combined here in California, a large part because some voters are thinking it's quote independent when it's not independent. It's actually a very right-wing organization. Whether they should actually change that or whether it's on the voters to be a little bit more informed in a democracy, I mean, that's more of a philosophical question, maybe even a legal one. So to some degree, I kind of understand why they're looking to make the change. I don't know if this is the most pressing issue in the history of California one way or the other. But I do think there is some evidence, though, that people are signing up for the party, not knowing exactly what the party, quote unquote, party is for.
No other way you could explain it, given the politics of California.
Exactly.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has unveiled a plan she says is designed to lower the cost of prescription drugs. She said she'd like to work with the White House on it, as lowering drug prices is a stated priority of President Trump as well. The idea calls for taking the 250 most expensive drugs being sold in the country that don't have at least two competitors, and the price of the drug would then be subject to negotiation to everybody who purchases it, not just those who were Medicare beneficiaries. And there would be a tax that would be assessed on the sale of these drugs if the manufacturers choose not to cooperate with the federal government on negotiating the prices. So it would begin at 65% of gross sales of the drug, going up, I believe, to 95%. Now, that's not profit. That's the gross collection of the sale of the drug. Matt, your thoughts on this proposal?
Yeah, you need a PhD to kind of figure out all the different components to it. I don't know whether the proposal is necessarily going to go anywhere, but there's going to be interest on both sides of the aisle of doing something. We're heading into an election year in 2020. Trump's made this a priority. Republicans are very worried about their seats as it is. And this is something that is of concern to a lot of Americans. Now, it's always, the devil's always in the details because everybody talks about prescription drugs. I've been doing presidential campaigns 20 some odd years. They've been talking about for 30 or 40 years. They got to, you know, whether it's the, you know, got to import them from Canada, whether you need to, you know, to tie these to the federal government's prices or some kind of negotiating prices.
Drugs,
yeah, there's just so much to it, and it tends to get a lot of discussion, but not all that much changes. So we'll see if something actually pushes down the line. But I do think there is some political imperative. Democrats are going to want some kind of win and will want some backing for whatever their nominee is doing. And look, Trump's going to need, especially with other stuff happening like Ukraine, he's going to want some kind of populist policy win. And especially if the economy is looking a little bit shaky, it's kind of up and down right now. So I think he's going to want something. So I think there's some political alignment. Chuck Grassley, the senator from Iowa, is also looking to do something. So I do think there's some political will, whether something really substantive will actually happen. This Congress has been pretty up and down, so we'll see.
Sean, do you think there's any way in the world the parties could work together on a prescription drug plan?
I'm not sure. There's actually a new book out by a gal named, Catherine Ebon, I believe her name is, and it's called A Bottle of Lies. And it's she writes about what's going on with the generic drug industry and the fact that that was supposed to be the great cost saver. But what's happened is most of the drugs have gone overseas to India and China, and a lot of problems with that. So I just think that it's a very, very muddy water right now. And when you look at that issue, you can tie this issue in, and it just will tie Congress up in knots.
All right. We're talking with Sean Walsh and Matt Rodriguez, who join us regularly on Air Talk to talk politics. There are a number of legal issues involving California and President Trump. First of all, a federal judge has blocked implementation of California's law to force the disclosure of any candidate for president's tax returns, any primary candidate. This was looked at by Republicans as a cynical ploy to try and decrease GOP turnout if President Trump wouldn't be on the ballot. We also have the president doing away with the EPA waiver, allowing California to negotiate its own standards, mileage standards with car manufacturers. California suing to stop the waiver revocation. Also, the president visiting San Francisco and Southern California last week, saying he's going to take action on homelessness, including looking at a citation from the EPA against San Francisco because of runoff, including syringes and the like going into the ocean. Sean, quick thought on all of these legal battles between the president and California.
I just think you're going to find members of Democratic legislatures trying to throw things in front of President Trump. So with regards to the taxes, the federal law and federal election law supersedes what it happens at the state. So that's a non-starter. And then any judge who can do anything else in California, it'll be overturned in some respects, both Republican or Democrat side at the circuit level. So I think we'll see a lot of this going forward.
And Matt, just real quickly, yeah, we are seeing some appointees, nominees, President Trump's, changing the composition of the Ninth Circuit, which has been a liberal bastion.
This is going to be a big concern for Democrats moving into 2020. Republicans have had a good run here in terms of Republican presidents, which means judges. If he gets another 4 years, you're talking about another one, maybe two Supreme Court seats plus federal judges. It's going to be a big part of this campaign.
Gentlemen, good to talk with you as always. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic political strategist, Sean Walsh, Republican political strategist. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Much more to come in the second hour. I'll tell you about it momentarily. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a great day. So glad you're starting the week with us here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Later this hour, I'm looking forward to talking with Caitlin Doty, who's author of Will My Cat eat my eyeballs. Big questions from tiny mortals about death. Caitlin operates a funeral home here in Los Angeles, and she's author of best-selling books, including From Here to Eternity. We'll talk with her about some of the most interesting questions kids have asked her, and adults, about death and the process of death. And we'll open up the phone lines for you, too. But we begin this hour with a conversation on vaping and e-cigarettes. The news from the Centers for Disease Control is that there are nearly 400 confirmed and probable cases of lung disease associated with e-cigarette product use or vaping. Those reports coming from 36 states. Additionally, there have been 6 deaths that have been confirmed for those who have used e-cigarettes, those deaths occurring in states California, Illinois, Indiana, Kansas, Minnesota, and Oregon. In the wake of those deaths and the CDC recommendation that Americans stop using vape products, that they stop vaping until more is understood about the causes of the lung illness and the deaths associated, we have seen states consider bans on flavored vaping products. We've seen them considering ways of trying to make it more difficult to sell vape materials or ways of making the age check more robust. And now we have the country's largest retailer, Walmart, say that it's going to get out of selling any vape products whatsoever. But the question is, does that, when you have larger retailers who have the resources to do age verification, who are able to actually vet the products that are sold in their stores, does that then leave those that vape looking at places that might be more dangerous for them to get potentially adulterated vape solutions? With us to talk about the bans is Dr. John Ma, who's a practicing general surgeon at Marin General Hospital in Marin County, just north of San Francisco. He's past president of the San Francisco Marin Medical Society. Dr. Ma, good to have you with us. Let me start first of all with, do you think it's a good thing that Walmart's doing this and other major retailers may follow?
Thank you for having me on the show, Larry. I applaud Walmart for suspending the sales, joining CBS, CNN, Warner Media, who've also ended their advertising of electronic cigarettes on television. I think this is strong leadership, good governance, important business principles. These electronic cigarettes are not regulated, and the entire industry has been in violation of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act for over a decade now. And so until we have regulation imposed, I believe this is the proper course of action to enforce the law.
Are you concerned at all that this may lead people to stop vaping and go back to cigarettes?
I believe that it would be preferable if people would discontinue vaping and use traditional nicotine replacement, lozenge, gum, spray. I think the key now is to educate the public that there are other options that are better than returning to traditional cigarettes. And I do appreciate the opportunity to raise awareness on that important alternative.
We've heard from listeners, though, in our various segments on vaping who are vapers who say, you know, I don't find the other nicotine replacement methods to be as satisfying that vaping gives me the oral pleasure that comes from smoking along with nicotine. So there are people for whom that's been the easier transition than going to other nicotine cessation. So, but you think that the harms of vaping are just so great that shouldn't be in the mix for people to stop smoking?
I congratulate those people who have been able to reduce their traditional cigarette intake by vaping. I would encourage them to continue to try to be completely nicotine abstinent. We are seeing a lot of dual use. We're seeing people converting to vaping chronically. It would be preferable if they could actually achieve vaping cessation. I think that should be the goal. And I believe that the traditional methods, I agree, it's challenging. Sometimes using them in combination with behavioral counseling, the recommendations and assistance of a physician, I think we should develop strategies to help people move away from vaping.
We're talking with Dr. John Ma, practicing general surgeon at Marin General Hospital in the San Francisco Bay Area. One of the guests who we've had on to talk frequently about vaping and tobacco products, as well as cannabis, is Mark Kleiman, a professor at, in the past at UCLA and then moved on to NYU. And in going to contact him, we found out he'd passed away. He was a frequent Air Talk guest. He died at the age of 68 back in July. He's someone who was a very prominent voice in this area. Joining us now from Reason is Jacob Sullum. He's senior editor at Reason, the libertarian-minded publication. He writes about drug policy. Jacob, good to have you with us again. Your thoughts about Walmart ceasing to sell vape products and what the effect of that might be?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to make it clear that the vast majority of these cases of severe respiratory illnesses that have been reported, where we have information available about what products people actually used, the vast majority of those cases are related to black market cannabis products, not to nicotine delivery devices, not to you know, legally available e-cigarettes such as Juul. So it's important to recognize that. Some of those cases may be related to vaping nicotine using counterfeit products, pods that might be represented as being Juul pods, for example, but that aren't really. And the main theory about what's causing these cases is that there are adulterants or additives in these products that are purchased on the black market that are causing these problems. And that makes sense because these legal nicotine products have been wide use for years, but we haven't had reports like these until recently. So it seems to be something new, and particularly something that's associated with cannabis products, or at least things that are represented as being cannabis products purchased in the black market. So really, that's a distinct issue. When it comes to making it harder to obtain legal e-cigarettes, I think, you know, my main concern is the one you mentioned, which is that people who have switched from smoking to vaping may go back to smoking, which is a far more dangerous habit. If you look at the studies of biomarkers in people who have switched from smoking to vaping, you see that the levels of hazardous chemicals to which they're exposed are far lower, involve far fewer chemicals than they would be getting when they're smoking. And in fact, the results are comparable to what you see in people who use other kinds of nicotine replacement products, the pharmaceutical products that are FDA approved. A clinical randomized study that looked at how effective these various products are in helping people quit found that e-cigarettes are about twice as effective as the other products like nicotine gum or nicotine patches, that sort of thing. So it's, you know, great if somebody wants to quit smoking and they're able to do it using lozenges or patches or gum, but many people find that that does not work for them. And this should be an alternative that's available. And I'm much more concerned about the legal bans in places like Michigan and New York, and now the one that the FDA is planning to impose on the whole country, which would ban almost all flavored cigarettes. Now, the main concern there is, oh, well, you know, teenagers are using them. And in fact, teenage vaping has gone up pretty dramatically in the past couple of years. And it is absolutely true that teenagers like those flavored e-cigarettes. But it is equally true that the adult smokers who have switched to vaping overwhelmingly prefer those flavors. Only a very small percentage of them are using tobacco flavor, which is the only thing that would be tolerated.
I think we just lost Jacob Sullum. We'll try and get him back. I'd like to hear from you if you're someone who vapes, and we're talking about nicotine vaping, not cannabis vaping, not with THC. But if you're someone who vapes with a nicotine product, are you trying to adhere to the FDA's warning that people should not vape any longer because of concerns about these incidents, particularly of young people with lung damage and the six deaths associated, with the concern there's not enough known about that? Or do you feel like you get a product that's reputable, where you're not so concerned about adulterants and you've continued to use? 866-893 KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. And if you have decided that it's too risky to vape because of these reports, these hundreds of cases of people with lung damage, are you going back to cigarettes or are you going to another nicotine replacement project? Product? Are you going to patches, to gum, to something else, lozenges to take the place of vaping so that you don't go back to tobacco itself? 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page. Also, if you're someone who vapes, what flavor vape solution do you choose and why? Because there might be people who would wonder, well, why are people who've smoked cigarettes for years who have now converted to vaping, why would they choose flavored vapes as opposed to using something that has more of a tobacco that would be more consistent with the taste from actually smoking? 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Dr. Mal, let me come back to you and your response to Jacob Sullum's point that most of the adults who vape want to use the flavored non-tobacco tasting vape solutions, and that if you ban those, it makes it harder for vapers to stay with that product as opposed to going back to smoking.
The flavors are a masking agent. They can be addictive themselves, and they could be contributing to some of the respiratory illnesses. And I wanted to clarify, the CDC updated, it's now 530 cases nationally with 8 deaths. The electronic cigarettes, when they were first championed in New Zealand and Australia, they were actually flavor-free, and they didn't contain nicotine. They were available only in a pharmacy with a physician's prescription. The goal is to get people off vaping, to achieve vaping cessation, and I do understand that the flavors are appealing, but the goal here is to make vaping less appealing and less attractive, and particularly not to target children. We're seeing the counterfeit problem. I agree. It appears that it is counterfeit pods, Juul-alikes, the use of marijuana. We are seeing a black market that has arisen. I think it's great that Walmart and other companies are trying to clamp down on this problem. Really, the principle of prevention, of precautionary principle in protecting the public.
What about the argument that just from a personal choice standpoint, that if there are people who like vaping, it gives them pleasure, they like the buzz they get from nicotine and want to continue with it, and they're willing to, either they don't find they get addicted to it and they do it socially and are comfortable with that, or those that are willing to risk addiction to it, that it's worth it to them because of the pleasure they get from it. For those folks, why shouldn't they have the right to be able to purchase and use?
The Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was signed by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1938. There was a tragedy where nearly 100 patients died from a sulfa medication that had been dissolved in diethylene glycol to convert it from solid to liquid form. The Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act requires FDA scientific and regulatory review of any device in America marketed with a therapeutic intent. So the difficulty here is that the industry has been advertising e-cigarettes as a smoking cessation aid. We've seen in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal that the FDA has warned Juul in particular about marketing products as safer than cigarettes. These marketing strategies and advertising approaches have been illegal. It was on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle yesterday. Your question relates to adult choice, and if individuals want to undertake risky activities, they do have a right to do so, but the real concern is the way in which these devices have been marketed and made available to the general public. They should be aware of the risks up front of using these devices. In general, it's probably not a great idea to light anything on fire, whether it be a cigarette, traditional cigarette or marijuana or e-cigarette, and put it anywhere near your mouth. And so my hope is that we can educate people that it is a dangerous choice.
All right, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. John Ma of Marin General Hospital, where he's a general surgeon. He's also the past president of the San Francisco Marin Medical Society. And we're talking with Reason Magazine senior editor Jacob Sullum, who's written extensively about vaping. We're at 866-893-KPCC. And if you're someone who vapes, I'm interested in hearing, first of all, what type of solution, what flavor do you vape? And this is not about THC or cannabis-related vaping. We're talking about nicotine-based solutions. And are you someone, given the hundreds of people who've had lung damage as a result, apparently, of using some sort of adulterated solution in vape products, are you now moving off of vaping? And what takes its place for you? Nicotine replacement or going back to smoking? We certainly hope not. 866-893-KPCC. Back in a minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk with funeral home owner and writer Caitlin Doty. Her new book, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big questions from tiny mortals about death, questions from kids that she gets, as well as adults, about dying, about what happens to our bodies, how they're processed, all those things. And I assure you it won't be morbid, at least as far as I'm concerned. That's coming up a little bit later this hour. Right now, we're talking about the health concerns around vaping as a number of states, Michigan leading the way with its ban of flavored vape solutions. But Walmart, the nation's biggest retailer, announcing last Friday that it would no longer sell vape products. But the question is, does that have an unintended negative consequence, driving more vapers to buy their products at places where it may be a black market solution, something that's adulterated, that puts their lungs at greater risk than perhaps a product they would buy at Walmart or another major retailer? We're at 866-893-KPCC. Arthur in Pasadena, I understand that you used e-cigs as a way to get off of tobacco?
Yeah, so I'm a pretty classic college smoker that decided that enough was enough after I graduated, and so I switched to the vape recently. And after hearing everything in the news, you know, around these mysterious deaths that are, you know, not a little bit concerning, I think the only thing that would make a decision easy to make is if there was just more comprehensive studies, you know, that with definitive findings, both in regarding the black market products that allegedly are making, you know, people die, or the, you know, a comprehensive study on, you know, commercially available and seemingly safe products that, you know, says, yeah, you know, people haven't died yet, but here's what you're exposing yourself to that will make you die in a few years.
So what do you do to try and make sure that the vape solutions you get are not going to expose you to risk?
I buy the ones from the normal stores, and I buy the ones with the names I recognize on them, right?
Yeah. And so have you had any negative health consequences that you're aware of from vaping?
No, except that I smoke, you know, that you do it more. I mean, there's a legitimate, you know, when I talk to other people who quit smoking by vaping, the number one thing you hear them all say is that you just, you may or and most likely imbibe more nicotine on a vape just because of the, frankly, it's much easier to do, and you don't stick up your house by smoking inside, right?
And, I'm sorry, Arthur, what kind of solution? Do you use flavored solutions?
Yeah, I was hearing you talk about that. I use the mint one. I don't really care about the taste because, frankly, I'm kind of just in it just to not be smoking a cigarette, right? So the cigarette doesn't taste great, but I remember for a while when I just got started, I remember thinking, God, I actually like, you know, the cigarette a lot better. It's a little bit, you know, a tough thing to characterize, but, you know, there's something about, you know, the feeling of a cigarette, and I know it sounds like a weak kind of explanation, but now that I'm much more comfortable vaping than I am smoking, and I'm happily doing so and not touching cigarettes, you know, I'll just, you know, the mint flavor is what I smoke, And, you know, tobacco flavor is also what's available. But, you know, and frankly, either one of them are better than a cigarette.
All right. Arthur, I appreciate it very much. And I guess I'm surprised, someone who doesn't vape, that the flavors are more popular than the tobacco flavor, because I always hear about different cigarettes and, you know, why people smoke a particular brand of cigarette over another. And I assume the taste was a big deal for cigarette smokers. Again, I've never been a cigarette smoker, so I don't have any firsthand experience. But I always thought that the brands really mattered to people. It wasn't just to deliver the nicotine, but that the taste was a big deal. So it's interesting to me to hear that mint and menthol and other flavoring has superseded tobacco flavors among those getting off cigarettes who've moved to vaping. Let's see. Let's talk next to Steve in Ontario. Steve, you vape, what sort of vape supplies do you use?
Well, I actually use a typical vaping mod device where I have to fill a tank with the vaping juice as it runs through. It's usually about a 6-milliliter tank. And I use it just several times a day. I told the screener that, you know, I've suffered from anxiety and depression pretty much my whole life. And I started smoking as a way to self-medicate. And vaping got me off of cigarettes after almost 20 years of smoking. And I tried to quit vaping and then immediately had a bad depression and went back to smoking. And then I said, no, I'm going to stick with vaping, even though I buy low nicotine level juices and try to limit my usage. I still feel it's a much better form of dealing with whether it's addiction or everything else, as opposed to going back to cigarettes and smoking.
Have you tried to use lozenges, gums, or patches to see if that was able to effectively curb your depression or anxiety?
I have. I've actually used a patch. I've also used, it was a drug, an oral medication that I took, got through my doctor. And I've also tried to use the gums, but it didn't quite work for me. And to be quite honest, I don't mind. I actually kind of enjoy the flavored vapes or flavored juices and options I have available, to change it up once in a while, like, you know, going out to a different restaurant, every other night or something.
So if there was to be a ban on vaping, would you go so far, you think, as to try and purchase it underground, or what would you, I mean, given that this links to your mental health?
Well, I don't know if I would go as far as to purchase underground, but I also happen to have some expertise in understanding just the basic chemistry of the components involved. And most of them are relatively easy to get. So I would probably go to mixing my own juices. I would probably make another serious attempt to quit entirely and avoid cigarettes, but I might go so far as to actually start trying to order the components and mix my own juices, because it's not that difficult.
And so there are people who do that. Okay, Steve, I appreciate it very much. David in Santa Monica, I understand for about a year and a half, you've been using a vaping device. So were you a former smoker?
Yeah, so I started smoking in law school, and then when I tried to quit after law school, I was on and off. I'd finally quit for about a month and a half. My friend introduced me to the Juul, saying it was a totally, you know, safe alternative. And after about five, you know, uses of his on different occasions, I went out and bought my own, and it is so much more addictive than cigarettes. I mean, I'm doing it literally 24/7. I have it in my hand while I drive. I have it in, you know, when I go to sleep, I have it, you know, every 10 minutes or so I'm needing to use the Juul, and I definitely notice health effects on it. I mean, it's hard to run a mile. You feel like a weight in your lungs, like it's filled up with syrup, and I want to quit, but it is so much more addictive than cigarettes because it doesn't smell, the ease of use.
Ah, that's an interest. I'm really glad you raised that. Another caller raised that issue about how much less of a hassle it is to vape as opposed to a cigarette, because it doesn't create the same environmental sort of notification to everybody that you're smoking. So, David, if they were banned, what would you do?
Honestly, I hope that it is banned, because I don't want anybody to be doing these things. It's
so bad, and I'd do my darndest to quit. But it should truly be banned, even though it helps some people quit smoking. And it is amazing at helping you quit smoking because you don't need it anymore. But it is so much more addictive than cigarettes, and it's more expensive. It's terrible.
Have you tried using another cessation product?
I've tried the gum and stuff before, but that, for whatever reason, made me sick. And honestly, you mentioned if it was to be banned, the smoke shops still sell everything that are banned. And I mean the smoke shops that are in your regular grocery shopping malls. They have all the flavored products. They don't check kids' IDs. I mean, they need to really try hard to ban this properly.
All right, David, I appreciate your call. That's David in Santa Monica. Jacob Sullum of Reason Magazine. We've had a chance to hear from a number of listeners on this. Your thoughts of what we've heard?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, Dr. Ma is absolutely right that if you light anything on fire and inhale the smoke, you're going to be exposed to all kinds of carcinogens and toxins. But e-cigarettes do not involve combustion. They don't involve tobacco. And that's why they're so much less hazardous than conventional cigarettes. I think it stands to reason that a lot of former smokers would actually want to avoid the flavor of tobacco if that's something they associate with their former habit. And in fact, the evidence indicates they overwhelmingly prefer other flavors. So I think those should be available. Dr. Ma thinks that e-cigarettes should be made less appealing by law. And the rationale, I think, is that it will make it less appealing to teenagers, which is probably true, but it also will make it less appealing to both vapers who have switched from smoking and current smokers who are thinking about doing that. You know, the former head of the FDA, Scott Gottlieb, was very concerned about underage vaping, but at the same time, he described e-cigarettes as a tremendous public health opportunity. If you can get people to switch from smoking to vaping, you're potentially talking about saving millions of lives that might otherwise be lost to smoking-related disease. So that's not a small thing, and you really have to weigh, even from a strictly public health point of view and not from a libertarian point of view, you have to weigh the consequences for all of these smokers who could have quit with the help of vaping or have actually quit and might go back to smoking. You have to weigh that against the concern that teenagers are using these devices, given the relative risks involved. And by the way, I should also say that for teenagers who otherwise would be smoking, it's unambiguously better for their health if they're vaping instead. And if you look at the trends in teenage smoking, the level of the prevalence of cigarette smoking has reached record lows at the same time that the popularity of e-cigarettes has exploded. And in fact, the downward trend accelerated as e-cigarettes became more popular.
All right. Hey, Jacob, I need to break, but I thank you for being with us. Jacob Sullum, senior editor at Reason, the libertarian-minded magazine. John Ma, Dr. John Ma, practicing general surgeon, Marin General Hospital. Back to you for your comment about Jacob's point that teen smoking of cigarettes is down considerably and that, vaping may be taking the place of that and that that's better.
There's an estimate that there are 5 million kids vaping. There's concerns that for every one adult smoker who quits with a vaping device, that 80 youth will initiate and possibly progress to lifetime smoking. I agree with Arthur. We need comprehensive studies. The CEO of Juul was asked and said, you know, frankly, we don't know about the impacts of chronic vaping. We haven't done the long-term longitudinal clinical testing that we need to do. For Steve, you know, congratulations on the vaping assistance. Be careful with the older generation devices that have batteries. Actually, lung disease has been described since 2017, and there have been fires, explosions from vaping devices causing injury to the eyes, face, serious concerns there. And finally, with regard to David, I agree that trying to market these as completely safe is very dangerous. To get to your question about adult choice,
yeah,
the public knows that these e-cigarettes could be more dangerous than traditional cigarettes if you develop one of these fatal lung illnesses or if it explodes in your face. So there are a lot of unanswered questions here, and I applaud Walmart joining all the other corporations and national action in this regard to address this public health crisis.
Dr. Ma, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it. Dr. John Ma, past president, San Francisco Marin Medical Society and practicing surgeon at Marin General Hospital. Coming up on Air Talk, writer and funeral home operator Caitlin Doty. She's got a brand new book out on some of the most common questions kids ask her about death. It's titled, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? We'll be back with more right after a live update from Hedy Lyn Hurdies. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Terry talks with Tegan and Sarah, twins, singer-songwriters, and LGBTQ icons. They have a new memoir about their tumultuous high school years and a new CD. That's Terry Gross with Tegan and Sarah on Fresh Air at noon, just 20 minutes away here on KPCC. I promise we won't be morbid because there's no reason to be morbid, like in a negative way, about the topic of death. It's actually great fodder for conversation. And with us, someone who knows that very well, she's a writer as well as funeral home operator, Caitlin Doty. Her new book is Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals about death. Caitlin, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for having me.
So are people shocked to have someone like yourself who's, you know, not dressed in a dark suit and sort of what we think of as the conventional male undertaker of our youth, to have someone who's so different in yourself who's in this business?
I'm 35 years old. I'm a woman, and I love talking openly about what happens behind the scenes at a funeral home. And that is not the model we're used to. We're used to a secretive older man who's doing something strange and arcane behind the scenes. But I genuinely feel that families, especially if they're grieving, especially if they've had a loss, feel so much better and so much more empowered if they really know what's happening to mom when they send her back for an embalming, or they send her back for a cremation, or they send her for a burial. What does that mean? What can you expect? What's really going to happen to her? Because this is someone you loved, and you don't want to just send her into the back without having that knowledge. So I genuinely think, even though it's hard to talk about, it's death.
Yeah.
The more knowledge you have, the better, paradoxically, that you feel.
You call yourself death positive.
I do. And that doesn't mean when dad dies, you go, oh, yes, finally. I mean, some people, if you had a bad relationship, sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
We hope not. But it just means that having this open conversation and talking about reforms that the funeral industry needs, it's so expensive to die.
Well, and isn't that one of the reasons why cremation has grown so much?
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. You know, you can spend $10,000 in Los Angeles, you can spend $15,000, $30,000 on a funeral and burial plot because real estate is expensive. Funeral homes are expensive in Los Angeles, but you can also get a direct cremation for under $1,000. So if you are low income, you need to be aware of these options.
All right. Well, we have our phone lines open for listener questions of Caitlin Doty, author of Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? You can ask her any questions about the process of handling a body after death, what the body goes through after death, 866-893-KPECC, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Not that those that work in this industry are monolithic in their views of it. There's some probably just treat it as a job and like any other job you'd be. But I would guess for other people that they see it as a sort of a spiritual, like a calling and bringing comfort to family members. What is the range that you see of people who work in the biz?
I think if you don't come into it with either a spiritual calling to it or what I have, which is also a historical obsession with the industry and how it's developed, I don't think you can last very long in the business because it's a tough job. It's long hours.
Physically demanding?
Physically demanding. Families crying, screaming, emotion, of course, naturally. And it can be very wearing if you just look at it as a 9-to-5 or a 9-to-10 or a 9-to-2 a.m. as it is in the funeral industry. So if you don't have more, a higher purpose for why you're doing it, I think it can be incredibly hard. And we have a high burnout turnover rate in the industry.
What is it that attracts employees? Are they individuals who there maybe aren't a lot of other job prospects? Is it that it's well paying and that's attractive? What is it?
It's not well paying for the most part, unless you're an owner, not an owner like I am, but an owner of a large
unless you're Rose Hills, Forest Lawn.
If you own Rose Hills, you're doing probably pretty well. I think that what most people don't realize getting into the funeral industry is that they really think they get to practice their craft on the dead. But the funeral industry is a lot more about the high stakes emotions of the living, because it's really, yes, you can be an embalmer, you can prepare the body, you can cremate the body, all of which I've done. But really, it's about managing the expectations, the emotions, and the sometimes incredible sorrow of the family. And so you have to have the ability to not only be alone part of the time, but then also come out and really show empathy without taking in the sorrow to the point that you are debilitated and not able to do your job.
Well, that's got to be very – it's almost like a grief counseling in a way. Obviously, you're a representative with a product, so you're looking at sensitively dealing with the family, but also you're in business and you're selling products and services. How do you do that in a way that it doesn't become formulaic, that you're actually with every individual family that you see, but you're also doing business? That seems like a tough line to toe.
We are doing business, but we started off as a nonprofit. We have a different business model. Basically, we want the family to be as involved as possible. We have low prices, and we want the family to be there helping prepare the body, being there for the viewing, helping us dress the person, being there for the cremation, actually pushing the button to start the process, being as involved as possible. And that makes me feel better about doing this work, because I feel like we are giving the power back to the family, who can feel incredibly disempowered. But the number one thing that I've learned is that when working with a family, if I can help them, I've done my job. My job is not to take on all of their sorrow. They're doing enough of that on their own. They have friends, they have family who take on their sorrow and grieve with them. My job is to be competent. My job is to help them through the bureaucracy and help them in their healing. And if I've done that, I can feel good about myself.
Yeah, and to hear them, because I, you know, one of the things I think a lot of people struggle with when they go through this process is feeling that they're heard and understood.
Absolutely. And starting with the idea, I don't start with the idea that the funeral director is the expert. I start with the idea that the family is the expert on their own person who has died, their own loved one. And I'm just there almost as a, not as a party planner, but as a counselor to make that happen. I'm just there to help them help themselves do what they need to do.
You practice in East Hollywood here in Southern California, where, you know, people from all over the world live and are your potential customers. What degree of cultural education do you need to have to be able to serve that clientele?
I think you do need to have these awareness. And obviously, we have certain families that we've come to be more expert in than others. We have a Spanish-speaking arrangement counselor. But I would say that the number one thing you have to do is just listen to the family. Listen to the family, listen to their religious advisor, listen to what they want to do, and open the door to make it happen for them. Again, I'm not the expert. The family, their community, they're the expert on what they want for a death, burial, cremation.
Again, our phone lines are open for you to ask questions of our guest, funeral home operator and author, Caitlin Doty. She's author of a couple of very well-received books on this topic, and her new one, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortal About Death. You get a lot of questions from kids about death?
I do. The title of the book, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs, is from a young boy in Australia. I was doing a writing talk there, and he raised his hand, and I was just like, man, that is a perfect question, because it taps into existential anxieties we have about looking at our own cats across the room and their little glowing eyes and wondering if they're thinking about something nefarious. But it also is a question that maybe adults have, but we never got answered as a kid. Most kids are told, oh, that's morbid, that's weird, don't have those questions. It makes adults uncomfortable, so they don't give good answers to kids. And then kids grow up not being comfortable with death, and that's such a shame.
So do pets eat their owners if their owners die?
Spoiler, eventually they will, especially cats. If you do not feed them for a period of days, they will go for what they need to go for. And dogs, what they've found is that they actually act more out of anxiety that their owner, they have an emotional bond with the owner. The owner's not waking up. So they start to nip and tear at the owner. So it's not as much about...
To try and get a response.
Exactly, to try and get a response. So it's not as much about food for cats or for dogs as it is for cats, which I think many people might suspect already.
All right. We'll continue with Caitlin Doughty. Will my cat eat my eyeballs? Now we have the answer. We'll be back with more of the questions she answers in the book and take your calls as well at 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. We've got word on the Emmy ratings for last night. Ooh, boy. Just under 7 million people nationally. That is a 32% drop from last year. According to Nielsen, the first time ever viewership for the Emmys has been below 10 million people. In this case, way below 10 million people. So that bad news for the Emmy telecast. I mean, the other thing they're dealing with is TV viewing is so fragmented now. It's not like there are very many programs that everybody comes together and watches. Right now, we're talking about death and the questions most frequently asked of funeral home operators like Caitlin Doughty, author of Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big questions from tiny mortals about death. Richard in Palm Springs, pleasure to have you with us. Your question, please.
Hi. I was wondering, in the state of California, if someone were to die in your home, like a relative or a friend, how long can you keep them in your home and clean them up and be with them until you are required to call the police or a mortuary or something like that?
That's a great question. I'm so glad that you asked that. It depends on whether or not the death was expected. So if someone, there was no illness, they're not under hospice, you have no idea what they died, absolutely you have to call the police and they have to come investigate. And sometimes they might say, this person is old, it's fine, we release them, but you do have to take that step. However, if a person's death was expected, if they're on frequent medical care, if they're on hospice, if they're basically expected to die at home, you are so empowered to take as much time as you want. Usually, if you have a funeral home in mind, I would call to just let them know that the person has died so they can start the bureaucracy part of filing the death certificate. But beyond that, you can keep that person at home for 2 hours, 12 hours, 1 day, 2 days. And what I've found is that something happens after a certain amount of time. After you spend time with a person and you hold their hand, you fix their hair, you tell stories about them, somebody, another family member comes, something shifts. Something fundamentally shifts. And you go, oh, wait, I get it now. Mom is dead. She's gone. This is not her anymore. And I now feel comfortable letting her go. And at that point, you call the funeral home and say, thank you so much. We're now ready to let her go. But don't let either a hospice worker, who are usually incredibly well-intentioned but might not know, or a nursing home person or anyone say, no, you have to call a funeral home immediately. It's an emergency. It's not an emergency. Unfortunately, they are dead now, and they're going to be dead 12 hours from now.
It's very nice. When my longtime best friend, our Morning Edition host here, Steve Julien, died, I guess almost 4 years ago now, and I got to his house before he died. He was terminally ill with a glioblastoma brain tumor. And so I was with him when he passed, along with his wife. And it was very nice because he was in his bed. And so close friends were able to come and be with his body after he died, before they came and took his body to the funeral home. And it was a very nice thing. It was obviously emotionally difficult for everybody, but the ability to have that moment, you know, with his body, I think was a very nice thing.
I'm so glad you did that.
Yeah.
I'm so glad the family.
I mean, it
got
left
that
me with a
that.
With a wonderful memory, you know, my last time of seeing him after he passed, and it was a very positive experience.
And sometimes when people are dying itself can be hard. It can be difficult. It can be strenuous. Watching someone die can be hard. So being able to watch someone at peace after they die, and knowing that they're not suffering anymore,
that's a good point. Yeah.
Can be a really positive transition in a way.
Yeah, that's a very good point. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's see, we have Shannon in Woodland Hills. What happens when you die and your organs are donated? How does that process work?
Well, one thing about organ donation that you should know is that if you're donating the big organs, the big charismatic organs, your lungs, your heart, etc., they have a very narrow range of people who are eligible for donation like that, because you have to basically still be entirely healthy but just have brain death or brain damage, which allows those organs to still be functioning great and still be fresh. And so those are the people that they will ask if they will consider donation of major organs. But after that, you can still have a funeral. You can still do all the things you would normally do, cremation or burial. But you can also donate smaller things like your corneas or long bones or certain types of skin that are smaller, less invasive procedures, but can still be incredibly helpful to someone who needs them.
And that's done at the funeral home?
That's sometimes done at the funeral home, sometimes done at the hospital. Basically, the people who do those donations will somewhat go where they need to be. They're on call and they'll show up and they'll do the removals as needed.
Susan in Santa Monica wonders, what's the most eco-friendly way to be buried or cremated?
Oh, great question. That's definitely what we call green burial. And there's a couple answers to this. Basically, green burial, there is a place in Santa Monica that does that, but it's very expensive. So we use Joshua Tree Cemetery, and they have a beautiful green burial space out in the desert, which means just your body wrapped in a nice unbleached cotton shroud, an organic
casket.
You can have a casket, but it has to be made out of something like seagrass or something very decomposable. And that goes straight in the dirt. But we also have, in 2020, we've legalized alkaline hydrolysis or aquamation or water cremation, which is basically the more environmentally friendly alternative to cremation. So instead of cremating someone down to ash with fire, it's with high heat water and potassium hydroxide. But the basic end point is the same. It's just done with water instead of fire.
So does that fully dissolve
exactly.
the body
it's
into sort of a solution?
Exactly. It's sort of a flash cremation, but what you end up with is the exact same bones or ashes.
Oh, you do get ashes.
Exactly.
Okay.
So it's the same end product, you could say, as a cremation, but it's more environmentally friendly.
All right. Very good. Let's see. Frank in Riverside wonders, is there training for doctors and nurses on funerary practices, embalming and the like, and can there be more transparency for families and doctors involved talking about the practice of embalming?
Yeah, I would love that. What we've created at our funeral home is a pamphlet called Helping You Help Your Home Funeral Families. And I'd like to expand that, because families should know that embalming, the chemical preservation of the body, is not required. It is absolutely not required. A funeral home can say, we want you to do this. We think it's best if you do this. But you always have the right to say no.
You can bury. Now, can you do that in one of the big cemeteries? Will they accept an unembalmed
absolutely.
Body?
Yes.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
All right. And that's because it's in a vault. Is that, I mean, that it's not
right.
a health
But also
issue.
With green burial, if a cemetery doesn't offer just natural burial, bodies straight into the ground, that's their choice as well. But it's legal everywhere. You
All
don't
right.
have to embalm. It's legal to keep the body at home. And you can green bury anywhere in the United States.
Caitlin, thanks so much. Appreciate your being with us, talking about your very interesting book on death.
Thank you.
Caitlin Doty, funeral home operator and writer. She's written a series of books on death. Her latest, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death. Have a terrific afternoon.